Question: is this a crisis or a situation? Discuss. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. It is Wednesday today, the 15th of March. Good as always to have you along, everybody. It wasn't hypothetical, that question I started with. It was more like abstract or metaphorical, kind of, as we feel our way through the global banking agita that is now upon us. Global, because today, after Silicon Valley Bank and Signature Bank, we now have Europe entering the chat with the Swiss bank Credit Suisse announcing there were material weaknesses in its past financial reporting. Shares got clobbered today. There was much back and forth about new capital that might, or as it turns out, might not be available. We're not sure yet. There are reports the European Central Bank has asked other lenders exactly how much exposure they have to Credit Suisse, because when situations like this happen, contagion is the big worry. Marketplace's Mitchell Hartman gets us going.
Credit Suisse was already in a world of trouble before this week, says Cornelius Hurley at Boston University Law School.
If there is any problem going on in the global banking system, Credit Suisse has acted as the spear receiver for it.
Credit Suisse has been scandal-plagued for the last few years.
Karen Petru at Federal Financial Analytics says the bank's got a reputation
for flying very close to the edge. A number of serious scandals with fraudulent borrowers, terribly lax internal controls.
Petru says those problems are unique to Credit Suisse, but in the current climate of fear and uncertainty, it's got global investors worrying.
Any bank of its size that is so accident-prone is a very high-risk institution. And then people are looking again and very askance at other high-risk institutions.
Today, investors looked askance at the rest of Europe's banking system. Nicholas Veron with the Peterson Institute for International Economics says they're not likely to find too many problems.
The European Central Bank, which is the lead supervisor for banks in the Eurozone, has been pretty focused on interest rate risk and the kind of things that people have been obsessing about in the context of Silicon Valley Bank in the last few days.
Karen Petru says Credit Suisse doesn't pose a systemic risk to the U.S. financial system the way Silicon Valley Bank did, but
Credit Suisse is a systemic level global player. And so the financial system as a whole is facing yet another point of significant fragility.
A risk of global contagion?
I hate to say it. I think the answer is yes.
Swiss regulators disagree. They say Credit Suisse's problems aren't related to the turmoil in the U.S. banking system, and that they'll provide liquidity to the bank if necessary. I'm Mitchell Hartman for Marketplace.
On Wall Street today, as often happens on days like this, panic is the gut reaction, then the buyers see their opportunities down, but nothing like it could have been, which kind of validates the situation. Hypothesis, by the way. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. Thanks to the implosion of SVB and Signature, we all know a lot more about regional banks today than we did a week ago. These aren't the big Wall Street names like Bank of America or Citigroup, and they're not the community banks with maybe just a couple of branches. They're basically the ones in between. And this week, the ratings agency Moody's said it's reviewing half a dozen of them for possible downgrades. That includes First Republic and Western Alliance Bancorp. Those two and others have taken a market beating the past couple of days as well. Marketplace's Amy Scott explains what's going on.
Unless you live in their region, it's likely you've never heard of some of these banks, or hadn't before they were all over the news this week.
With some regional bank shares face-planting, how stable...
The First Republics of the world, the PacWest Bancorps of the world, some of the others.
First Republic, Western Alliance, Metropolitan Bank, among the biggest laggards.
First Republic and PacWest are based in California, Western Alliance in Arizona. Lakshmi Balasubramanian is a professor of finance at Case Western Reserve University. She says regional is kind of a loose term.
it's not incredibly well-defined, right? When you talk about a region, is it a state or contiguous states, a certain district?
Texas-based Comerica Bank has branches in Arizona, California, Florida, and Michigan. First Republic is scattered throughout 8 states, including Wyoming, New York, and Massachusetts.
Especially as you go up in size, the geographic footprint of these banks can get pretty broad, to the point where the large regionals, I mean, at that point, you're almost at like a national scale.
Morningstar analyst Eric Compton says there's one main reason regional bank stocks have been in turmoil this week.
The government's never going to let like a JP Morgan fail. However, regional banks, not viewed as systemically important, maybe the government does let them go under, and then there's an off chance that maybe your deposits are at risk.
In the case of Silicon Valley Bank in California and Signature Bank in New York, the government did step in and insure all deposits.
But that doesn't always happen. There have been banks that have gone under where depositors were not made whole. And so I think that's why regionals are getting penalized more right now.
SVB and Signature were unique banks with uniquely risky circumstances, but investors and bank customers are suddenly wary of any others with similar issues, like a high percentage of uninsured deposits and large holdings of bonds that have lost value as interest rates have climbed. Mark Williams is a former bank examiner who teaches finance at Boston University.
So the concern would be that as flight of deposits move to the biggest banks, then the smaller banks are made vulnerable.
Williams says regional banks play an important role in the economy. They may offer more flexibility and personalized service than larger banks and make loans to small and medium-sized businesses that might otherwise be ignored.
They represent important niches in the marketplace.
To restore faith in the system, the Fed is also offering emergency loans to help banks cover withdrawals and considering tougher rules for mid-sized banks. Lakshmi Balasubramanian says the situation has shown that when it comes to systemic risk, size isn't the only factor.
We don't want the regulatory burden to be excessive on smaller institutions. But if it's complex or overexposed, or, you know, if it's of a certain risk profile that makes it more susceptible to, say, bank runs, it becomes important for us to be cognizant of that.
Yesterday, Senator Elizabeth Warren and other Democrats introduced legislation to reverse Trump-era deregulation of mid-sized banks. They say contributed to the recent failures. I'm Amy Scott for Marketplace.
If you remember the financial crisis, specifically the beginning-ish part where the Fed and J.P. Morgan stepped in over a weekend literally to save, depending on how you look at it, Bear Stearns, you might have noticed nothing similar happened with SVB this weekend. Why? To talk about that whole part of this thing, we've gotten Liz Hoffman on the phone. She's the business and finance editor at Semaphore. Liz, good to have you back.
Thanks for having me.
So we've got the FDIC insurance over the weekend. We got the new lending facility in case of emergency over the weekend. We did not get a sale of SVB, and I want to know why.
You know, what we reported was that the biggest banks, the ones that everyone loves to hate, but also the ones that are really the only people in a position to do something like this, yeah, were not invited in until it was effectively too late to get a deal done by Monday, which is when the market was expecting it. So, you know, I think that is now being rectified. They are trying to sell this thing again. And I would expect bigger banks to sort of be more encouraged to participate in that process.
Why were they not allowed in the door the first time?
Look, you've heard too big to fail. Yep. People don't like them. And in particular, the chairman of the FDIC really doesn't like them and doesn't want them getting bigger. And he's talked about that a lot in the last couple of years. So it was a political calculus that this was the moment to sort of take a stand on this issue.
Do you suppose there's a downside for Jamie Dimon et al. To not want to be in, to finishing this deal?
I don't think there's a lot of appetite among the big guys to do this. First of all, Jamie has said publicly that he wouldn't do Washington Mutual and Bear Stearns again, and it wasn't worth it to him. And I think the lessons of 2008 are going to make people pretty reluctant unless it's basically free.
By which you mean, you know, the government would provide some sort of risk assurance, right?
Yeah. There is a $15 billion hole in that company, and it's got to be filled by somebody. And I don't think there's a lot of appetite for big bank CEOs to have it be them.
I want to touch on something else you wrote about in this piece where you laid out sort of what's going on with the acquisition. You are not sanguine about the fate of regional banks in this economy, and I want you to explain why.
So what the Fed did over the weekend, what they didn't do is they didn't say we're going to end this run. They said we will fund it. So these banks are now vehicles for us, the Fed, to put money in the pockets of very panicked depositors. The problem is that the funding that they are offering is way more expensive than the funding that it's replacing. So you're going to end up with these banks that are smaller, much less profitable, trading at steep discounts, and they're going to end up getting picked off. So you're going to end up having this fight about bank M&A one way or another and too big to fail.
Yeah, so back to the bank M&A. Do you think the SVB deal gets done somehow?
Well, so there's three pieces of Silicon Valley Bank. There are the deposits, which are being insured. There are the loans, some of which are very good, some of which are probably a little dicey. And then there's the investment portfolio. And that is really problematic because that has a huge hole in it. So the FDIC may say, all right, we will hold on to that. We will run it down over time. It's mostly treasury bonds and Fannie and Freddie debt, mortgages, that kind of thing.
Right. These are the long-dated things that everybody's been talking
the
about.
The long-dated things that got them into trouble. Exactly. Right. And we will match the deposits with the loans and sell that to somebody. That's got to go to a bank. So, you know, the cleanest solution and the one that regulators are now hoping for, though they shot themselves in the foot over the weekend, is for a medium-sized bank to step up.
Well, yeah, but I mean, SVB, as everybody has heard a zillion times, was the 16th biggest bank in this economy. And you're going to tell me some medium bank is going to come in here and go, yeah, all right, we'll do this.
Well, there's nine banks that are seven through 16, right?
Yeah,
before you get to the really big five or six. You have PNC. My understanding is they ultimately were not interested. You have Truist. You have U.S. Bank. But, you know, a lot of these banks themselves are facing the same problem, albeit not at the scale that Silicon Valley Bank was. But these guys are in the business of taking deposits and buying things with them. So there's a lot of this stuff out there. And the second you have to mark it at its true value, whether by having to sell it or by selling the firm itself, there's some accounting math that puts that underwater really quickly.
Liz Hoffman is the business and finance editor at Semaphore. Her book on the economic, it actually was a crisis that preceded this situation about the pandemic in corporate America, is called Crash Landing. You ought to buy it. Liz, thanks a lot. I appreciate your time.
Thanks, Kai.
It's been back-to-back inflation data this week. We had the Consumer Price Index yesterday, up 6% year-on-year, as you heard on this program. Today came the Producer Price Index, that's wholesale prices, up 4.6% from this time last year. We had Sam Fields on the CPI story for us yesterday, housing as a driver of inflation specifically. And there was a term in that story that we figured needed another pass. The Federal Reserve, in its never-ending quest to get a more refined view of why prices are doing what they are doing, has taken to looking at something that's come to be called supercore inflation, which strips out housing and all goods, actually, leaving just core services. Marketplace's Stephanie Hughes is on explainer duty today.
In the past month, I hired a babysitter, got a haircut, and bought baseball tickets. All those purchases are measured in supercore inflation. Alan Detmeister is an economist at UBS who also worked at the Fed.
It includes a lot of what people actually spend their money on, particularly if it's for work by another person.
The Fed watches this measure closely because the prices of baseball tickets and haircuts can be linked to the wages people are paid to cut hair or throw a baseball, points out Princeton economics professor Marcus Brunemeyer.
We would like to know how the wage dynamics will look like going into the future, because then it will feed into inflation down the road.
Bredermeier also points out the vast majority of the U.S. workforce is employed in providing services, including him as a teacher of economics and me as a reporter. And Oxford Economics' Ryan Sweet says that means that, unlike goods, many of which are produced internationally,
this is the part of inflation that the Fed can control.
And it can set monetary policy accordingly to try to cool the labor market. It's worth pointing out, though, supercore inflation is not an official term used by the U.S. government. Some people measure it differently, and some economists flat out dislike it. Again, UBS economist and Fed alum Alan Detmeister.
I avoid it like the plague because I think it's a terrible term.
Detmeister says that wages don't always track with service prices, so how much we pay for baseball tickets or haircuts now doesn't necessarily give us a clear picture of where inflation overall is heading. I'm Stephanie Hughes for Marketplace.
Retail sales for February came out today. Things cooled just a bit, down nearly 0.5% from January. And we are spending this week looking at some unsung economic indicators and what they can tell us about this economy. Today we go retail adjacent.
Anything that you purchase typically comes to you in a box.
That's Rachel Kenyon. She's the senior vice president at the Fiber Box Association with what some call the Cardboard Box Index.
What we measure is all shipments of corrugated. So it can be boxes, it can be bins, it can be bulk containers.
The Fiber Box Association releases quarterly data in billions of corrugated square feet. It peaked in 2021. However,
what you saw happen in 2022 is the second half of the year, really the fourth quarter, was the weakest.
Shipments were down about 8.5% from the quarter before, and as it happens, retail sales cratered in that same period. We here will keep an eye out for next month's corrugated data to see if it matches up with today's retail sales drop. Coming up.
And Congress, which is Congress.
Could not have put it better myself. First, though, let's do the numbers. The Dow Industrials dipped 280 points, almost 0.9%, 31,874. The NASDAQ added about 5, closed essentially flat, 11,434. The S&P 500 shaved off 27 points, about 0.7%, 38,091. Today is the Ides of March. Thus, for the history majors among you, Caesars Entertainment shares down 3.6% as fellow casino operators did not have great luck either. Boyd Gaming, which owns several casinos in the South and Midwest, decreased 1.9%. Las Vegas Sands shrank almost 5%. Bond prices rose. When that happened, the yields go down. The yield on the 10-year Treasury, 3.46%. We were dancing around 4% like 10 days ago. You're listening to Marketplace. This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdahl. Those regional banks we have been hearing oh so much about, and also just banks too, have something of a public relations problem on their hands. How to convince their customers that they are not going to be next. Marketplace's Savannah Marr has more on this latest corporate communications challenge.
On Monday morning, customers of Cambridge Trust Bank in Massachusetts found this video in their inboxes.
I'm speaking to you today as a result of recent developments in the banking industry. And with regard to
CEO Dennis Sheehan explains that his bank does business differently than the two that failed.
Our balance sheet is conservatively managed, and we have strong capital, strong asset quality, and robust liquidity.
Keeping things positive is the right approach, according to Mary Spaeth, an expert on crisis communications.
If you say, don't panic, everybody, of course, goes, and they panic.
Spaeth says that bank leaders are trying to project confidence right now. When I saw that one bank CEO invited anxious customers to call his personal cell, I gave the number a ring.
What you're really saying is you read that letter and you go, oh my God, I can't believe this guy's that stupid, so I got to talk to him.
Brad Tidwell heads up Verabank, headquartered in Texas. His number went out to about 70,000 customers. 100 or so have reached out. He spent hours fielding those calls.
I thought it was real important that we get our story out. Our bank is nothing like these other banks. And oh, by the way, if you have any doubt about it, call this phone number and I will talk to you.
With lots of misinformation swirling around, including on social media, he says that time spent working the phones is worthwhile. I'm Savannah Marr for Marketplace.
I got my brackets done just in time. The men's NCAA basketball tournament tips off tomorrow. The women go on Friday. But amid all the bright lights and buzzer beaters lingers the messy world of name, image, likeness for college athletics. Bruce Schoenfeld, he's an author and contributor to the New York Times Magazine, wrote not too long ago about how those NIL deals are changing the economics of college athletics. Bruce, welcome to the program.
Thanks, Kai. Good to be here.
Let's get the lay of the land here on name, image, likeness. What is the current state of play?
Flux. It's a complicated situation because the current lack of restrictions were sort of thrust onto colleges with no warning. And the going on 2 years since then have basically been a real-time reaction to all of a sudden having your athletes be able to do in any extreme, something they weren't able to do at all before, with no guardrails and no guidance.
So who's in charge? I mean, is there anybody keeping an eye on this?
I mean, you and I are keeping an eye on it, but it's just people like us. Unfortunately, the only entities that really could regulate this are the NCAA, which in its infinite wisdom chose not to, and Congress, which is Congress.
Enough said there. So look, this is fundamentally an economic problem, right? Because while college sports are a multi-bazillion dollar business, there are only so many bazillion dollars, and now the pies are having to be split. Talk about that a little bit.
You know, there are many unintended consequences to this. I think everybody felt that it was a good idea. The problem there is that unlimited amount of money that's coming in is coming in from sponsors and boosters who were already using it in ways that were helping to sustain all the rest of college sports. Right. And now that money is all going to the quarterbacks and the running backs and the point guards and the power forwards to the detriment of all the other sports that need it to survive.
What happens then to the rest of any given school's maybe non-revenue sports, but also, you know, second tier-ish kind of sports? I mean, are they not getting any money now?
Well, you know, it remains to be seen what happens. The funding mechanism for those sports is through the athletic department. Mm-hmm. The athletic department gets its revenue from a handful of ways: television contracts, ticket sales, and boosters. That money now, instead of going for the swimming pool, the best thing I can do on behalf of my university is to go get that prep quarterback. Mm-hmm. Now, putting aside for a moment that one of the few restrictions on this is you're not supposed to be using it for recruiting, right. Everyone's doing that. And that is money that has to come from somewhere and that was doing other work.
It kind of sounds not sustainable, Bruce.
It isn't sustainable, and that's kind of one of the good things in that everybody in the ecosystem agrees that something has to change. The problem is there's not a lot of agreement on how it should change. So we go back to the beginning. What's the current state?
Right.
It's just in flux. It keeps changing week after week based on new developments.
So look, for all the flux and the murkiness and the pain, you know, sort of that's coming from this, do you suppose this is a necessary step to get to the point where, number one, everybody recognizes that college sports, especially big time college sports, are actually, oh, look, a business, and B, we figure out how to make it function as a business?
You know, a lot of athletic directors felt that the old system wasn't working, and they were headed for an economic problem, even apart from the remuneration of athletes, that there needed to be changes. And maybe the answer long term is that not every school will have every sport, that each school may have a couple of big time sports and not much else, or it may play out in completely different ways. The problem is no one has any idea.
Yeah. Bruce Schoenfeld, frequent contributor to the New York Times magazine, whence this piece that we're talking about came. Bruce, thanks a bunch. I really appreciate it.
Thanks, Kai.
This final note on the way out today, saw it in the Wall Street Journal, but you can go on eBay and see for yourself. There is apparently a booming secondary market in Silicon Valley Bank swag. You need an SVB branded blanket? Can do. $26. An SVB cheese board? $200. You got branded laptop bags, aprons, and cardboard boxes, too. All right, we are going here, though, is your moment of economic context. You know, sometimes you want to know where the economy is going to go. Oil can sometimes be your guide. The U.S. benchmark West Texas Intermediate down 4% today, under $69 a barrel for the first time since late 2021. The trading bet here, and please consult your own financial advisor, is that slower economic activity will mean lower oil demand, thus lower prices are the results. Or, you know, not. Watch it spike tomorrow. Our media production team includes Brian Allison, Jake Cherry, Drew Jostad, Gary O'Keefe, Jeff Peters, Charlton Thorpe, Juan Carlos Torrado, and Becca Weinman. I'm Kai Rizdahl. We will see you tomorrow, everybody. This is APM.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.